Business and Economic Development will open up as a subcommittee to begin. And welcome everyone on another beautiful, for the, I understand, fourth consecutive record-setting day, which is good now. It'll be bad later, but it's sure beautiful out there now. As we're going to start the agenda today, as you know, the Public Utility Commission made their ruling today and have decided to reject the offer on the table. And this committee over the last month and a half has been talking about these issues generically and now more specifically. And I think it will be the goal of the committee to be more aggressive in the next few weeks on these issues to see what role we may play based on the information we heard earlier and what we can do to assist if we identify that role. So we'll see a number of these things before us. I want to welcome Senator Walker, who's going to join us for a few minutes for our first item of the day, and that is public hearing on Senate Bill 1008. And I'm invited testimony, if you would like, Senator Deckert and Representative Berger and Senator Nelson to come forward. What we're going to do today is we will hear this bill in public testimony later, but I was asked and agreed to let our colleagues come and give us at least the primer on their proposal, so we'll have an idea of, again, what's in our basket here, and then we will dive into this more at a later date. So with that, Senator Decker, you took the middle chair, so I guess that means you're going to start first. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ryan Deckert, State Senator District 14. You're right, it is a beautiful day, and I think a good day for Oregon consumers with the PUC ruling. We're here today to announce the introduction of Senate Bill 1008, which creates a customer-owned utility to buy and operate PGE. Our name for this new utility is the Oregon Community Power. And with me to my right is Senator David Nelson, and to my left is Representative Vicki Berger, who are the chief co-sponsors of this legislation. In recent months and over the last several years, we have watched PGE, which serves nearly half of all Oregon's residential, business, and industrial customers, toss in the seas of uncertainty. As we know, first there was Enron, then Sierra Pacific, a proposed sale to Northwest Natural that unfortunately fell through. Then we had Enron's bankruptcy, a silent auction that did not produce enough bidders, and finally today we found out the fate of Texas Pacific Group's attempted purchase of PGE, which was rejected by the PUC. While finding a new owner for PGE has proven problematic, there has been little doubt PGE customers would wind up footing the bill for more debt to pay for the purchase. Senator Nelson, Representative Berger, myself, and many, many others, and I think that's something we have found in the week since we've introduced this concept, is many others are saying we have looked on long enough. Now is the time to put an option on the table that says if customers have to pay for PGE, they should just do it one time and own the utility. Customer-owned utilities are common. They serve 43 million American homes across the nation, two-thirds of the state of Washington, obviously, and many of our colleagues are in customer-owned utility environments. They provide reliable electricity service, often at lower rates. And if you just do the scan across the country of those 48 million Americans, the average is about 10% less, though it varies across the country. Their highest recommendation, I believe, Mr. Chair and members of this committee, is local control. It is something that we have desired for this utility. We want to bring PGE back to what it always has been, which is a locally controlled utility. And our bill with a public corporation, I think, accomplishes many of the aspirations that so many have had from the businesses and residential customers. It brings all of the benefits of the treasury and the tax-exempt status of purchasing, but also, like OHSU, like the Port of Portland, it feels like a private corporation in terms of its operation, which I think gives you a lot of the benefits of private industry with the public mission that this proposal brings to bear. We believe in local control, and we believe Oregon Community Power may be the only way to achieve it in regard to Portland General Electric. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In light of this morning's announcement, I think it's timely that you're beginning today to address Senate Bill 1008. As a result of today's proposal or events, I suspect many proposals will be surfacing to address the status of PGE. Timely resolution is important, but I have mentioned before, this is not some race to a mythical finish line. We need to act deliberately and intelligently at this point. And I am I have my name on this proposal because I think it is our best option. What this legislation envisions is a utility formed as a public corporation like Port of Portland or Oregon Public Broadcasting. What you get is a business with a public mission, which is exactly what we need in Oregon when it comes to PGE. A board, under this legislation, a board will oversee Oregon Community Power that is appointed by the governor and represents the utility's service territory as well as the communities with the utility's power generating facilities and intertransmission lines. Board members will be chosen for their business expertise and knowledge of utility operations. Some of the key objectives of Oregon Community Power. One, to provide reliable power at the lowest cost to customers using advantages available to public power utilities, such as access to lower interest rates. To charge fair rates for all customers. To preserve the existing utility distribution system and the workforce that maintains it. And to develop a smart, low-income electricity assistance program. Oregon Community Power will have the authority to enter into negotiations to buy PGE using the revenue bonds backed by the assets and cash flow generated by existing PGE operations. There will be no general obligation bonds, and state taxpayers won't be on the hook for these bonds. It will be a customer-financed purchase, with the customers, Oregon ratepayers, ending up being the owners. Would you like to finish, sir?
Batting cleanup.
Oh, thank you, thank you. I'm batting third, but going cleanup. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from Pendleton. I represent District 29 in Northeast Oregon. And what we're looking at this thing is, this is a statewide issue from our viewpoint. In Pendleton, or not in Pendleton, but in Morrow County, and we have two PGE plants. We have a coal-fired plant, we have a gas-fired plant. So it's very important to me from my viewpoint to be involved in this process. It's also, we have rural co-ops. There's preference power issue. There's a lot of issues. And I think as Senator Deckard, and I'm very pleased that he brought this bill forward, I'm very supportive of it, is that, maybe we don't have all the answers here right in this particular bill, but we're certainly willing to sit down and trust the good sense of this committee and the legislative process to customize and design an organization that will answer these questions. We know it's a complex issue, but we can, I think with the interested parties involved, with the ability of the Senate committee and the legislative process, we can come down to those things, customize the design, meet the needs for the ratepayers, look at this as a statewide utility and interest that we are protecting. We just feel that, folks back in New York or maybe in Texas, wherever they're at, their interests are not really an interest of the Oregon ratepayers. They're probably looking at money when it comes right down to it. The thing we know about PGE, it's a very successful company, and that's why they're interested in it. So let's use it here in the state of Oregon for the benefit of ratepayers and for the benefit of the whole state. I think we need a local utility we can count on to protect our interests. I think that's a really crucial thing. We're open to options. You're probably going to see the lots of them surface, but I think, let's let the game begin. Let's get all these facts out here. What are the issues that we need to really be addressing? And address them in a productive and legislative way so that we can get all the facts on the table and be transparent about it. Do the right thing for the state of Oregon. So I appreciate your time, and you guys are going to have a great time.
Well, thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Deckard, we have had a number, as you know, as a member of the committee, a number of thoughts on what both the PUC and ultimate disposition of PGE may look like to the benefit of of its ratepayers and certainly the Oregon economy, because as you mentioned, it's over the majority of customers, public utility customers in the state. Commissioner Stan, of course, has had his proposal for the city of Portland. Maybe you might just give us a very brief comparison of why you believe that this option, from a public power option, you know, so we're just talking about public power, from a public power option, would be more advantageous than the city of Portland's, in your view.
You know, we get asked, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we get asked that often. Just got asked it three times by three different reporters.
And I'm sure you have a good answer to hear.
Well, here is the strengths of this proposal. Without commenting on what the city of Portland is working on, is there's 5% and 25%, 5% of the geography and 25% of the load is included in the city of Portland. This brings 100% of the service territory and 100% of the load. The transaction on this proposal is pretty clean. We just did a 2.5 pension obligation bond through the Treasury, a revenue bond of a little less magnitude, although the bidding will begin, is something that our state treasury, and we've already began to talk with them, is accomplished and has done and can do. The board of directors is representative and very similar to the, if you look at the PG board of directors that they have today, the way we've outlined it with utility expertise, so that the utility that you see 5 years ago would be very similar to the utility that you have. And so we really believe, whether it's OHSU or the Port of Portland, that this public corporation model tends to work pretty well, because the mission, if you look at a utility, it's a monopoly, and so all of the customers that are embodying that utility are subscribers to that, to Portland General Electric. And so this model, we think in the next 2-3 weeks, we feel pretty confident that as folks look at least the two options that we know of out there, the city of Portland, this, without commenting at all on the city of Portland's offer, that this one will have strengths that folks more and more, as they look, will be attracted to. And we can do a section by section if you wanted that. We're prepared to talk briefly, just section by section, what the bill does.
First of all, questions from the committee at this point?
I had a question.
Please,
if
Senator Walker.
Mind. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for allowing me to sit in. I've had an avid interest in this issue for a while. I'm not sure which of you distinguished legislators would like to answer this question, but I was reading the bill, and I don't see anywhere where anyone is watching the money. And let me say at the outset that I've had some experience with some semi-public state agencies that don't mind their money well. And I've looked here in Section 7. It says the Board of Directors of Oregon Community Power shall file with the Legislative Assembly and the Governor not later than April 15 of each year a report of the activities and operations. But that doesn't really tell me a lot. So how would we know how this Oregon Community Power is spending its money, and how do we know the ratepayers being taken care of, and that the state isn't the taxpayers? I understand Representative Berger said the taxpayers aren't holding the bag because we're doing revenue bonds, but still, we need to know who's watching the money.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, I think that's a great question. I think that really illustrates the questions we need to be asking in this. I mean, how do we craft this thing? I mean, I don't think we have the answers right here to say this is how we're going to do it, but we're going to rely upon your expertise and expertise of interested parties in this thing to say, okay, this is how we're going to make this thing really a very workable. We can customize how we do it. And so, I mean, that's the kind of questions that we need to be asking. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? I think what I'm going to do,
Mr. Chair, yes. Representative Berger looked like she wanted to respond.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If I may address another piece of this. The timing here is very good, because these are important questions, and embedded in here are hundreds and thousands more. But you and I know the legislative process is a very good way to get those things out on the table, to get them addressed. So I think that this vehicle is also excellent for putting together, through your committee, the way to get these things answered. getting the questions out and then getting them answered in a process that is known and familiar and works. So the question is good. There's lots more like that. I like the timing particularly of this and the legislative process for this.
Mr. Chair, just one other thing on the watching the money, because I think it's important to us as we've deliberated over this, that really is at arm's length, that it really is a public corporation, and it's able to operate, and so you wouldn't have a lot of legislative involvement, and I think that's an important point to note of watching the money, that you would have a board of directors like PGE has today that is responsible to answer those questions, and I think it's important that whether folks like that answer or not, that that is the model that we have in mind, is that arm's length model, not one that we would have any, the legislature would have an interest or a role in terms of the day-to-day operations.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that response, but I winced because we have another board of directors that wasn't watching the money. And so, you know, you're right. There's thousands of other questions like that, Representative Berger, and I think this is a great starting point, and I'm really looking forward to it. It's too bad I don't sit on this committee, but I'll have to miss my other committees to make sure I stay involved. But thanks for your response.
Okay. Any questions of the panel? I think what I would ask is, this bill was just printed. It still seems almost warm from the last couple of days. And the chairman of revenue asked that we bring this forward just as a way to kind of throw it out on the table. And so I'm not going to ask you to go through a section by section at this time because our agenda had already been pretty well set, but wanted to let the public know that this had been introduced, what the general concept was. I think one thing would be very good in the days ahead before we bring this back for further scrutiny would be to have legislative counsel and maybe the treasurer's office work on a section by section analysis, so because that will be the first thing that we'll do when we open this up for public testimony, so that people will be able to condense some of those issues and some of the ones that Senator Walker brought up and certainly have always been of interest of mine in terms of oversight, public transparency, if we're going to go this route from the state, would be things we'd want to look at and to analyze. So thank you very much for your interest in bringing this forward, and we will be working on this bill in the future. Thanks for taking the time. Okay, we'll close the information hearing on Senate Bill 1008, and I'm going to go a little bit out of order as the room clears, and we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 579. And
Krasinski's on his way.
And he's not here yet, okay?
He's based on Paul's office. So he'll
okay, so we'll ask Julia Clark and Marianne Guest to come forward. They're here. Here they are.
We call them, but have to wait for the questions.
Okay. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julia Clark, and I live in Eugene, Oregon. I support Senate Bill 579 with amendments. I lost my father because of the lack of common sense on a guided fishing trip down the Rogue River, and I don't want it to happen to anybody else. Chapin Clark lived in Eugene for over 40 years. He had been a professor at and dean of the University of Oregon Law School. His contributions to the community reached beyond the university. He supported the arts, health, and human services, to name a few. He loved the outdoors, was a mountain climber and a river rafter, and safety and respect for the forces of nature were paramount to my father. When my father signed on for the guided fishing trip on the Rogue in October of 2002, he assumed that he would have a good time, that the people taking him down the Rogue were trained and safety-minded, and that he would have great stories to share with his friends and family when he got home. He did not come home. Friday, October 4th, 2002, we got a call saying that he had drowned when his boat capsized on Coffee Pot Rapids. My father was wearing his personal flotation device, as was the other passenger. The guide was not. Nor was there a throw bag on board to aid in his rescue. Valuable time was lost waiting for the other boat to come and help, and my father's life was lost. In the deposition of the professional river guide, when asked if he had received any safety training, he replied no. When asked if the guide brought any safety equipment or safety gear on the trip besides personal flotation devices, he replied, no. When asked why he didn't have any throw bags on the boat, the answer was, it wasn't standard equipment. When asked if he had any practice skills of group rescue or group assistance for rescue, his answer was no. When asked if customers received any kind of safety briefing, again, the answer was no. When the guide was asked if the outfitter had any kind of rescue plan in the event of a boating mishap, the answer, again, was no. When asked if he had a personal rescue plan in the event of a boating mishap, the answer was no. Professional guides in Oregon are required to fill out paperwork, show proof of insurance, and have proof that they have taken a first aid course, but there are no other requirements. No requirement that the guides be trained in safety or rescue techniques. No requirement that the guides carry appropriate safety gear and wear life vests in difficult waters. Unfortunately, I'm here today to ask you to legislate common sense. I urge your support of Senate Bill 579 in remembrance of my father, Chapin Clark. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to, Ms. Guest, if I could, we have a representative and a senator, I believe, are here on this bill. Correct? So why don't I ask them to come forward. I know Senator Brzezinski as well. Everybody's busy getting to and fro committee. So let me ask them to come forward. Senator Brzezinski, welcome. I'll ask you to start. Ms. Clark has just told us the tragic story and in introducing the bill of her father, and I would go turn to you at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee member. Floyd Brzezinski, State Senator, Senate District 4. I really wanted to come down and give moral and I guess support for the process for Julia and her family. Representative Barnhart and I had talked. We had been contacted by another colleague and friend in Eugene regarding the situation and not knowing what actually had occurred down on the rogue during that incident. But once we both heard, it was something that we wanted to try to help facilitate the best we could. And it's my understanding is that the parties that are interested in this have been working diligently and I believe have reached some resolutions as to making certain that the changes that are being proposed through the legislation will in fact be able to accommodate the needs and provide some safety and at the same time allow for the industry to continue to provide the recreation benefits, but making certain that those individuals that are participating on guided tours and rafting are in fact going to have some reliance on the individuals that are providing those services when it comes to safety.
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. Representative Barnhart, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Phil Barnhart, State Representative, House District 11. I knew Chapin Clark as a law professor in the late 60s and early 70s. He taught the water law class, among many others. And I also knew him as a colleague and friend in Eugene. His death, under the circumstances that you've heard described, was a huge shock to all of us. And this bill really comes out of the needs to make some repairs on the basic rules of safety. Senator Brzezinski, I think, has stated the case correctly. I believe that there will be an agreement or at least a meeting of the minds on the details of the bill, and I fully hope that it will be able to go forward.
Yeah. Thank you. Any questions at all?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This was brought to my attention by a guide, and would, having taken my family on river rafting trips many times when they were young, when you use a throw bag, when you use a rope, sometimes that can get tangled up, and it would be sort of nice to also have a knife so that just in case you need to cut the rope for one reason or another. There are all of these little things that I think it's just common sense, and I was just wondering, Julie, if you would be opposed to having them either by rule or whatever to also make sure that there is a knife in case that throw bag of rope got caught up on something and would need to be cut.
Well, I would consider that that would probably be included in safety equipment. I think that that's in the training that would include the use of any safety equipment that would be prudent having that on board.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
if I could.
Senator.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, one of the things I would tell you is from my experiences in whitewater rafting, that is an essential tool. I mean, it's part of, there's so many applications for a knife. And you are correct. There are times where you would want to have that ability to make those types of decisions that need to be made. Of course, that would be limited to the guides as compared to the individuals. I mean, one of the things that I think is really taken for granted by many people who use rivers throughout this country, let alone just Oregon, is the magnitude, the force of water and what it can actually do. It may look like it's pretty calm and cool and collected, but the reality, it can sweep you under very quickly. And my training and working with the outdoor program at the University of Oregon, there are pretty much a couple of things that many people have on their life jacket will be a whistle as well as some type of knife or cutting apparatus, so they in themselves will be able to take those type of steps if necessary.
Yeah, thank you. The point I see of this bill is that the ordinary people who hire a guide to take them down the river expect that guides are safe, that they have thought through the issues that are involved in being safe on the river, that they know the rapids that they're going to be dealing with, and that they have the basic training that it takes to be able to do these things with competence. The current rules that we have don't require that, in fact, and the attempt in this bill is to fill that space. I think in its essence, I think the river guides absolutely agree with the idea, and we're, as I said, we're hoping that we'll be able to get the details down. I'm not a whitewater rafter, and so I don't really have an opinion about knives, but I think you've heard a couple of good ones.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Thanks for bringing this for us.
Thank you.
Marion Guest, do you want to testify? I wasn't sure if you were just with Ms. Clark or...
Just for a moment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, I'm Marianne Guest, and I'm a friend of Julia Clark's, and I agreed to help her on this issue because it's really important to her family, and I've met her dad, and he's a great man, and we'd like to make the river safer for everybody. I wanted to point out that I have been working with the Oregon Guides and Packers, and I've been working with the State Marine Board Executive Director to come up with some appropriate amendments, and I was just going to go over those really quickly to you, some of the agreements we've come up with.
And they'll be coming up as well, so
right.
I think maybe why don't you stand down until we get them up here, and let's do that at that point. How's that?
Okay.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
Thank you. Paul Don Hefner from the State Marine Board. Welcome. Appreciate the August looking tie.
Try to keep things bright.
Thank you. Bright.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. We are the agency that registers all outfitters and guides in the state. Currently, we've got a little over 1,000 outfitters and guides total registered. And of those, the majority, 586, or 55%, are fishing guides. We only have 66 that are classified as whitewater guides, so that's about 6% of our total registrants conduct whitewater guiding businesses. And typically they're outfitting on rivers like the Rogue, the Deschutes, the John Day, the Owyhee, the Snake, and others where riding rapids is part of the thrill. As part of registration, they are required to furnish proof of first aid training and $300,000 worth of liability insurance. If they operate a motorboat, they also have to have a Coast Guard operator's license. And if they're accepting deposits over $100, they have to be bonded. This bill would add new requirements for those operating on Class 3 whitewater to possess a certification in whitewater rescue techniques. It would also require, as you've heard, to carry a throw bag and require guides and their passengers to wear PFD on Class 3 or higher rapids. I've attached to my testimony a copy of the International Scale of River Difficulty in case you're wondering what Class 3 or higher rapids consist of. This is a standard classification system that's used throughout the country. It has six difficulty classes total within it. Class 3 is rated as intermediate, and it's defined as rapids with moderate or irregular waves, which may be difficult to avoid and which can swamp an open canoe. Many of these standards are written around canoeing. Complex maneuvers and fast current and good boat control and tight passages or round ledges is often required. Large waves or strainers may be present but are easily avoided. Strong eddies and powerful currents can be found, particularly on large volume rivers. Scouting is advisable for inexperienced parties. Injuries while swimming are rare. Self-rescue is usually easy, but group assistance may be required to avoid long swims. That's the definition of a Class 3. And then you have Class 4, which is advanced, Class 5, which is expert, and Class 6, which is extreme. And so you can see the graduations there in that scaling. I think the idea of requiring a throw bag in guided boats operating on three or higher and the mandatory wear of PFDs, as you've heard, is really just a common sense thing that we can easily support from a safety standpoint. I believe most whitewater outfitters commonly do require their passengers to wear PFD when they're entering those larger classes of whitewater. I think that's a commonly accepted practice. Putting it into legislation certainly wouldn't hurt to reinforce that. We can also support some form of additional training certification if the legislature decides to do that. We've looked at what some of the other western states do in that regard. It's a mixed approach. Washington probably has the most rigorous program. They require a 50-hour training program and a formal certification, which can cost the outfitter and their employees several hundred dollars each. Idaho takes a little different approach. They require certification based on experience, at least three complete trips on the river in which they're going to be operating, or proof of experience running other rivers, which would typically be a log that's signed off by other outfitters or other employers who state that they will certify their experience. The states of Colorado, Arizona, and California do not require any kind of specialized training, and that's currently where our rules lie. Some form of outfitter self-certification that their employees are trained in specific river running skills and knowledge might be an appropriate alternative to the whitewater rescue certification that's spelled out in the bill. Normally, that kind of certification training is provided to fire rescue or search and rescue types of organizations. It's a little higher level of training than you would normally give to seasonal boatmen that row for you if you're an outfitter. But the outfitters can speak to their concerns with that a little more. But we think some form of self-certification there might be an acceptable alternative. We do have a couple of minor technical concerns with the bill. I've spelled these out on page 2 of my testimony. One, we want to be sure that the bill doesn't inadvertently include the large motorized tour boats that operate on Rogue River. Some of them do operate in Class 3 and higher whitewater. We don't believe that's the intent of the bill, but it is not drafted so that they're specifically excluded.
And I think we have a member of the committee who has a very high interest in that as well.
So that's one amendment we would like to suggest. The second and third concerns that we have are in Section 7 of the bill. The language on page 4, line 7, appears to require throw bags for all guided boats. And as I mentioned earlier, the majority of guides use or guides providing boating guiding are fishing guides. They're not operating necessarily in whitewater. They are required under state and federal law to carry a throwable life-saving device, either a seat cushion or a throw ring. And so the throw bag requirement might be redundant or excessive for the majority of those guides using boats that aren't operating in Class 3 and higher. It's not drafted quite as clearly as we'd like to see, so I think we had an amendment that would clarify that the throw bag applied to non-motorized guided boats operating in Class 3 and higher. That would alleviate that concern. And the final concern is a technical one involving the specific listing of Type 3 and 5 life jackets in the bill. Type 5 jackets are being reclassified. That classification is going away in the near future. And so rather than spelling it out in the statute, we'd like to perhaps leave that to agency rulemaking so that we can adjust to changes in Coast Guard regulations and UL classifications in the future. With those changes, we think it's a good bill and an appropriate change to the safety standards for outfitters and guides operating on the waters of the state. And be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Don Hefner, and appreciate your scrutiny of the bill. We seem like we're always passing legislation to correct obsolete language, and so if we can avoid that part, that's helpful, and also unintended consequences, and so your scrutiny of that is valuable. Questions for Mr. Don Hefner? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So why don't we have Phil Donovan and Paul Rainey come forward, and Mary Ann, you can come back up now. As has been pointed out, these folks have been working on amendments to reach an agreement on how we would proceed here. So, this would be a good way to kind of sort that out and find out where we are with this. So with that, Mary Ann, go ahead. Why don't you go ahead and call first?
Sure. I'm Mary Ann Guest, for the record, supporting Senate Bill 579. We've been working with Phil Donovan and his group, and the amendments that the Clark family is willing to make would be, and also in addressing, I just forgot your name, Don, sorry.
Don Hefner.
Don Hefner's concerns. We are willing to apply this only to non-motorized boats that float on Class 3 rapids or higher. The mandatory use of life vests was meant for all persons on the boat in Class 3 rapids or higher. It wasn't meant to be on flat water, used on flat water, so we're agreeable to that. We're agreeable to deleting the specifications of the flotation devices, which we understand are changing. And we agree that the requirement for throw bags can be modified to apply only to the boats that float on Class 3 or above rapids, instead of, again, duplicating what already exists in the law. The Clark family feels strongly that whitewater rescue training should be mandatory for those that guide in whitewater, but we are also comfortable with in-house training to minimize any expense, and also we're in agreement in specifying what those safety requirements are within the law. So we hope to have amendments to you probably in the next week that we could go forward with.
Okay, thank you. Phil and Paul.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Oregon Guides and Packers Association. To start off with, obviously the tragic death of Mr. Clark paints an emotional backdrop to the introduction of this legislation. To begin with, the elements within this legislation are common practice among Oregon's guides and outfitting community. We are safely providing thousands of trips every day, particularly throughout the summer months here in the state of Oregon. And as many of you know, I personally work as a whitewater guide for All-Star Rafting, and I can speak to the fact that requiring your clients to wear life jackets in whitewater, having throw bags on the boats, and that the training, which was done in-house, frankly exceeds what is called for with this legislation, which speaks specifically to rescue training. There's a lot more to guiding than just that. There's ability to read water, knowledge of the specific stretch of river, and as well as self-rescue techniques. So at first glance, the legislation appears obvious, but of course, the details and implementation are always a challenge. And so we've been in good conversations with the proponents of this legislation. director spoke to some of the challenges of certification as the legislation currently calls for, and I'll just quickly point out that tuition for this kind of training that's called for in the legislation is expensive, and it's also difficult to access because it almost always requires that the person be carrying health insurance. And due to the seasonal nature of many whitewater rafting guides in Oregon, sometimes they're college students. They don't always have health insurance. So having said that, the outstanding question that remains in our conversations is really what self-certification would look like. And we've got draft language or language that's been drafted by the Guides and Packers Association. We're holding it up against legislation from other states and trying to figure out what is the best route for us to proceed on. So with that, I'll close. I'll turn it over to Paul for just a quick moment to speak to the other two aspects of this legislation.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Rainey. Thanks for the opportunity to be here on behalf of the Guides and Packers Association. First of all, I'd like to state that we share the Marine Board's concern about the technical issues with the personal flotation device, as well as the throw bags and the jet boat tours and fishing boats. And we're currently working with the family of Julie Clark and the proponents to come to a compromise, and I'm pretty comfortable that we can get there on these issues. An additional thing I would like to bring up with the throw bag is the one-person rafts, also known as duckies. We feel that that may not be necessary to have a throw bag for those small watercrafts. With that, I'd just like to close and say that the livelihood of our industry relies heavily on our ability to ensure a safe and rewarding experience. And that we just ask that you work with us to help put in place safety guidelines that will benefit the industry and not put a restraint on the small businesses that we serve.
Thank you, Mr. Rainey. I think your points are well taken, and Senator Atkinson spends a lot of time on the river. I used to get to spend a lot of time on the river, so I see definitely both those issues, and appreciate your understanding of why this is important for those of you like Mr. Donovan, who does this on a regular basis. It seems second nature, and because understanding the power of water and the responsibility of taking passengers. As Ms. Clark pointed out in her story, however, unfortunately, not everyone uses that common sense. And when people come into, whether they're citizens of the state or whether they're visitors to our state, they have a right to rely on the fact that we are taking care of them, and we don't have some of those people who are being careless. They're not experts in white water. They don't know what the eventualities could be and what the training and the resources on board should be. And so for those folks, we have to make sure that that is consistent, as well as not in our enthusiasm for providing that actually endanger the sport itself and the ability to provide those services. So appreciate the fact that you are working so diligently on this. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. A couple of questions. Is in the compromise language you're working on, is throw ropes earmarked as the device of choice?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, it's all that's been defined within the legislation. If you had other ideas, what would be more appropriate, be very curious.
Okay. Is orange torpedo taken care of in the compromise language?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, looks like Paul wants to respond. I'll stop.
I see. Actually, their concern was that being a one-person raft was with the throw bags. They felt that was unnecessary for that. That was their main concern. They should be taken care of in the rest of the compromise language.
But you're nodding no.
I don't know what that is, Senator. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. It's a...
Never heard that term.
I'm sorry.
Terrible.
Hellgate's taken care of because they're motorized, and that's no longer... And the mail trips and all that's taken care of.
Yeah.
Yes, nodding, yes.
Senator Atkinson, they would be taken care of if the exemption for the motorboats was put into law.
What system does Alaska have in place? Because if this bill passes, we're about to make a couple of, we potentially could make a couple of businesses very wealthy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, I'm not familiar with Alaska's. We've looked at Idaho, Washington. If you're aware, again, of an aspect of Alaska's guiding industry.
Well, what I mean by making a few, we have friends, since I know quite a bit about this line of work, who do whitewater training in about five western states, and they cost a lot more than $275. Their course is, I think, $1,500 or $1,600 for a week, and it's only in the spring, and not everybody can afford to do it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, that's right. We've had conversations because what we've seen in the state of Washington is a cottage industry, if you will, spring up around the training of outfitters and guides. One nuance of Washington State is that, it's, as I understand it, it's the lead guides. Not every guide in Washington State has to go through the certification training that's referenced in their statute. That's what I've been informed by one of our members who guides in both states.
Well, I would be very leery if we were going to start regulating the people that teach whitewater training, because there's not enough of that industry in Oregon, because it doesn't pay, because no one can afford it. So most of those guys make their money in New Mexico and Colorado and Idaho, but skip over Oregon, even though they live in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, we are agreeable to providing, to allowing them to do some type of in-house training, and we are not requiring what you said at the start of this new cottage industry.
Okay, one more question, yes. Mr. Chair. Another thing, have we thought of, if you're going to require and define a rope, are you going to require and define a knife on a PDF?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, the knife suggestion was not one that has been talked about amongst us. I can only share that amongst...
Gerbers are made in Oregon, I mean, you know.
Well, my comment was going to be that most of us carry them because they're kind of cool to carry.
But most whitewater instructors will have a knife right here, mm-hmm, at all times, mm-hmm, and require that, mm-hmm, you know.
That's right.
If you were wondering what to get me for Christmas, oh, there's a gift limit, I'm sorry. But, I mean, if you're going to define rope, mm-hmm, and you're going to define training, you better go all the way and define knife. Because if somebody dies or gets injured from a rope, then, I mean, might as well look at every... I've lost friends because of ropes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, the knife is really kind of a new dynamic to this conversation. It's not one that I've that has been broached at all, so I'm not prepared to sit in front of you today and commit to a knife requirement. As I said, they're fairly commonplace.
I think just one thought on that is that maybe for noodling and with Mr. Don Hefner might be helpful on that as well in talking about this would be, you know, the idea is, and I know when Senator Atkinson and like myself go drift boating and fishing, you know, the knife is important because you're obviously your anchor line could become a death problem for you. And, mm-hmm, and but there might be some language, rather than be too specific, you know, it's have sufficient tools, you know, to prevent or to escape from, you know, a rope. I mean, and that could be a number of different ways, but I'm not the expert on that, but I think there's a way to ensure that the toolkit is accurate and complete to be able to free someone from any other circumstance. So I would work on that.
My concern here is that we get somebody who's getting their first summer job, and we give them say they're a guide, and they get their CPR, and now we give them a throw rope, and a throw rope can be just as dangerous, even more dangerous than other tools that are out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to admit on the record how many days I spent on the river, but I'm very nervous. I mean, a throw rope is a fantastic tool in the right hands, but it's also very dangerous in someone that's not trained.
We would certainly welcome your suggestions.
Other questions? One thing, as you work on this, and understanding our time frame, I know you've been working hard, and I appreciate that diligence. Continue to work, do that in a very forthright manner. And I would also ask, because we do have a real expert on this panel, as you come up with those, what you believe are final suggestions, I would ask that you contact Senator Atkinson and utilize his expertise, and then we'll come back to committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll have Tom Butler here. He's in my office. 5:30 in the morning.
Can we go rafting?
Well, yeah, a field trip. The president has encouraged us to take field trips. Senator Atkinson.
We'll visit this bill on the river.
Okay. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 579. I'm going to open up public hearing on Senate Bill 574 and ask that Scott Berry come forward. In fact, I'm going to ask all three people to come forward. Scott Berry, Craig Chisholm, and Phil Miles. We've got three people signed up in this bill. Let's have our dialogue together. Welcome, Mr. Berry.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And as this committee is already aware, from testimony from previous hearings, the construction liability crisis in terms of contractors' ability to get liability insurance is a major issue for us. Today, when a new house is sold in Oregon, the new homeowner obviously knows who built that house. They had a contract with that builder, and can go back and talk to that builder if problems occur on the house or there are instances in which they need to get a hold of that original builder. Unfortunately, when the house is sold to the second, third, or subsequent buyers, that information generally is lost to the homeowner. And most of us are probably homeowners here. I don't know how many of you, if you live in an existing house, know who your builder is, but most folks don't. This bill before you today, House Bill 574, allows the builder to record the original contract, including the contractor's name, with the property. And it simply is permissive in that they may do that if they wish to do so. From our point of view, I think for the homeowner, the bill provides them with information they wouldn't have had at their fingertips. And it allows them to contact that builder and maybe get work done to repair something before they end up going to an attorney or someone else to locate the builder of the original house. And so that's part of the reason we're pushing for this. We feel that original contact, and we've seen through the CCV process, that just the contact with the homeowner and the builder can solve 60-70% of the problems on a home. So in terms of construction liability or construction defect issues, that's what we're hoping to do with this. We're also hoping to allow that third homeowner to see the original contract under which the house was sold and understand what that means for them in the upcoming years. And we have talked briefly with the land title folks. We know they have some concerns and are happy to sit down with them and see if we can't work through those. Not a complicated bill, though.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go ahead with that. Let's go, Mr. Chisholm.
Craig Chisholm with the Legislative Committee of the Oregon Land Title Association. And title is really the concern that we have. We can understand that Mr. Berry's position is a laudable one, where he's trying to put information, disclose information. That's a good idea. There's lots and lots of information about real property. I have GIS information, surveys, land use, gobs of information. But I've been down here perhaps 15 times on similar bills with a similar central issue, and that is that the deed records are a peculiar set of information. The deed records are set up to deal with interests, title interests in real property or interests in real property. That's the basic concept, the set of information. That set of information is a set of information that can be changed by a stroke of a pen. You can have everyone sit around with rights to real property, sign off on it. If they can't, you can have the judge sign off on it. That is that type of information. This is a different type of information. This is an information related to perhaps some contractual rights between people, perhaps something about the condition of the property. The problem when it gets into our system where we are reporting in the title industry is that when we find information of record, we're going to report it as exceptions. Now, once we report those as exceptions, suppose we report a mortgage or an interest of Jones in a piece of property, that can be cleared. We can get track that down. In the worst case, you can get a judge to clear it. Once you put information about the condition of property into it, it is very difficult to clear it. Maybe it cannot be cleared from it. I could go into greater detail on that, but that's the basic problem. If he puts this material in, or this type of material goes into the deed records, in effect, it either clogs them up or brands that piece of property in a way that it cannot escape from perhaps some information that has long ago been resolved. Has nothing to do with title. We'll be happy to work with Mr. Berry. Maybe there's some way of looking at it. There are some thoughts. Of course, you have the GIS system, a wonderful thing that's coming up about conditions of property. You have seller disclosure statements, which is already a method for telling people about properties and rights on it. Perhaps there's yet another system for storing information. It's not that it's a bad purpose, it's the wrong vehicle. I won't put words in the mouth of the clerks, but we share a common interest in keeping the title records working and pure, and there are big matters involved in them. Hundreds of millions, billions of dollars. We've got to keep that system working. We don't want to solve one problem and create a potentially much greater problem. Before I close, I would want to say that I just learned about Chapin Clark's demise. He was a very favorite law professor at the University of Oregon Law School when I was there, and I'm sorry to hear about it, and want to say what a fine man he was and a fine teacher. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chisholm. Mr. Miles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Miles. I'm the Chief Deputy County Clerk for Marion County, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. We're really not opposing or promoting this bill. My observations today were more of a technical nature. As the bill is written, we have some concerns. If it should pass into law, it would be very hard for recording offices to handle it in its present form. For example, right now we had one observation that the language as it's currently stated only allows the contractor to record the document. Well, that's rather limiting for just the contractor. What about the property owner? You know, it's just something I'd like to point out that we noticed. From a technical standpoint, we also feel that the documents must be in a form that we can record. They must meet the recording standards that are already in law as to parties on the first page, so we know how to index the things. A legal description of the property, so it's attached to the property. Often the real estate contracts I've seen do not have legal descriptions but addresses. You know, there's technical things like that that I don't think the language right now is addressing. The current language also refers to the definition of a construction contract as defined in ORS 701-620. And that essentially means a written or oral agreement including all plans, specifications, and addenda relating to the various construction types. Problem is, we're not really sure how one would record an oral agreement or oral contract. So that would be a problem in and of itself. Secondly, I'm not sure it's really the intent here to have plans, specifications, and addenda that go into a construction contract to be recorded into the recording record. For instance, many plans and everything are huge. They're oversized. We don't have the technology in recording offices anymore to record something like that and microfilm it, because everything ultimately is on microfilm. And to microfilm this thing, you'd have to do it separately when you start getting into these big areas, like plats, for instance, that we do file in a plat book. So they're not part of the deed record, technically. They're part of the plat books. We do take those. They're oversized. However, they're not filed within the recording record, the deed record itself. So it would be physically very difficult for us to do some of this. A lot of the material on plans The actual written material is too small for us to reproduce. We have issues of legibility. So essentially we think as written, there's some serious physical problems for recording offices. What we were suggesting, perhaps if this whole concept goes through, is maybe a document creating some sort of documentation of the warranties expressed could be generated, and that would be recorded rather than as the current language is written. We don't really have an objection to it being recorded. There's really nothing in our recording records right now that's similar. So we're just taking a neutral stand on that. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Okay. I think the first thing, Mr. Berry, you've heard the objections. Why don't you, as the proponent, maybe respond to those, and we'll open up for questions that we don't think have been answered.
Yeah, no, I would be happy to. Thank you, Chair Metzger. Again, for the record, Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And I think even in our conversations before the hearing today, Mr. Chisholm mentioned something that would, I think, solve a number of the problems, potentially not all of Mr. Chisholm's, but certainly a number of them, and that is the bill today would allow subsequent contractors to amend that. We have no interest in having that occur. The intent of the bill was to have the initial construction when the builder is still the owner of the property, so the builder and the owner are the same, and the issue would only take place on the initial sale of a property, and potentially even just a residential property. So some of those things we would be happy to work out. For instance, making sure the documents are in a form that could be recorded easily for the clerks. No concerns about that. Obviously, we would not want any sort of oral contract to be part of the recorded contract. And again, we'll be happy to sit down with these folks and see if we can't work this out.
Another one that was pointed out was in the definition of ORS 701-620, explaining that provision in statute also included all documents, construction plans, I mean the whole building plans. Could be, is that your intent? Or
no, that is not the intent, and we would be happy to clarify that as well and just get the written contract, the information to the homeowner, and the warranty information, and that's it. And so whatever we need to do to make sure that those are the documents that would be recorded just on the initial sale of a brand new house to that first homeowner, so that it carries forward for the remaining homeowner owners of that house. That's again the intent, and while this bill doesn't do just exactly that, I think we'd be happy to sit down and make sure that that is what the bill accomplishes.
Mr. Miles, I have a question for you. As a county clerk, so when you go for a recording of this document, and I've brought in partition plats before and had them recorded, and they go in and get recorded. And when they purchase a house, it goes in and gets recorded. An easement, it goes and gets recorded. Under the way Mr. Berry has stated this, the idea being a simplified document, whether it's one, two, three pages or whatever, I think maybe the industry would have to probably work on, you know, what are the key pieces of information here. Would that create an undue burden if you had, say, a two- or three-page document which was information that would be recorded along with the sale of a new residence? Would that general concept solve some of the concerns you might have as opposed to all these other things?
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, it would. I mean, our fundamental problem is to get it in a form that we can actually record it. We do have a little bit of a concern just because it's a different kind of record that it's been in before. It doesn't really affect directly title or interest in property, you know. But we can live with it. It's not going to cause us heartburn.
Yes.
For the record, Craig Chisholm, a question for Mr. Miles. How would you index it on the grantor-grantee index?
Phil Miles again. Generally speaking, again, that was part of my issue on the format of the thing. I'm talking about having a document that was set up in a manner that we could index it to begin with. I would assume, not knowing anything more than what I've read in the bill, that it would be the homeowner would be party one party and the builder would be the other party.
I want you guys to know that the audience is riveted back there. I mean, the yawns that are coming here is amazing. From your two gentlemen's expertise, just as a what if, is there another recording place option where, and I don't know if there is, other than say that the county clerk went with the deed, do you have any other thoughts for Mr. Berry of where this information could be recorded that might not have some of those other issues?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Phil Miles again. One method would be it could be attached to a recordable document such as the deed as an addendum to or as an attachment to the document. It wouldn't be indexed separately, but it would be in the record. Often that's what people do now that are for documents that we can't record as a document unto itself. They will attach it to something that is recordable. That's one option. I don't know of any other method to record it, really. Not like, for instance, UCCs. It can be recorded if they deal in property at our office, and then they can be recorded at the Secretary of State. For this, I don't think there is anything else.
Okay. There's that I'm aware of. I guess you're stuck with it then.
Yeah.
If you want more technical detail.
Yeah.
All right, Craig Chisholm, with the Oregon Land Title Association. There's a vast body of knowledge related, or information related to every parcel of property, and there are all sorts of information related to property. You have surveys, for example, recorded or filed with the surveyor's office. You've got all sorts of information, scientific information in lots of places and so on. But the deed records are all set up on this grantor-grantee concept of title stuff. So you run into a threshold issue on this not being a title interest. And your question is where to put that. There have been some solutions to these problems in the past. For example, the geographic problem. There were a number of bills that came in here, for example, say a landslide-prone area. And the answer to that is put that in a geographic system. There are questions about individual pieces of property. Has there been lead paint? A whole bunch of issues about the particular piece of property, and that was solved by the legislature by having a seller disclosure statement that went from seller to buyer. They would have to disclose things. They would give information, and the idea is presenting information. That's great. That might be an avenue, possibly. Perhaps there's some other type of record. Maybe the home builders could keep it.
Well, there's an idea, huh?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one of my colleagues just reminded me of one avenue that's possible, too, is it could be filed with the building inspection when the building permits are issued.
Good. Well, now, next time we're going to have all the planning department here to tell us why they can't do that. Okay, questions from the committee?
Well, yes, just one little technical. I don't know how long a person waits to see if or find something wrong with how the house was built. But what in remodeling situations where there have been actually changes, how is that going to, will that affect you at all? Or you're only concerned about new buildings within 5 years? Or do you have liability issues that come up 10 or 15 years after a home is built? I guess I need to know a little bit more.
Chair Metzger, Senator Morris Anderson, our intent would just be on that original first sale and not to include remodels and other things that occur afterwards.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Phil Miles again. Another thing that occurs to me in answer to your question, historically the recording record really has never dealt with the structures on property directly, except for one exception comes to mind is the mobile home exemption, where the mobile home is made part of the property by exempting it from titling. Other than that, generally speaking, a building, a house that's on property, that documentation really isn't in the recording record. If you wanted to historically look at the history of Deepwood down here or something like that, you'd be going to the Marion County Historical Society, the building inspection office, people that issue the actual building permits, things like that, planning department, things like that. It wouldn't be the recording office. We just don't normally get into this type of an issue.
Okay. And historically for us, Senator Metzger, that's been part of the problem. So there's no easy way for that homeowner to find out who they should contact. So they hire somebody to go do that, and that's
right.
That starts the ball rolling.
Yeah, I understand. Words sound too much fun here. Go ahead.
Craig Chisholm, Oregon Title Association, Oregon Land Title Association. A similar problem comes up, and Mr. Miles mentioned it, with building codes and so on. Title companies don't have those. Those aren't recorded. But if you were buying a piece of property, it might behoove you to go back and check with the building people about what happened on the property and so on. How much you'd find there. It does have the great advantage that the building, I don't know this for sure, but I think they can change those. In other words, they can decide the building's gone, they can pull them out, whatever. We can't do that in the historical record. These are historical documents that can only be changed, or they're not really changed, they're removed by getting rid of all the rights. The rights have disappeared, or the title company thinks they've disappeared. And these are the keepers of the record over here, and they guard it jealously.
They do. Well, I think what will clearly where we are here, we've got an issue, Mr. Berry, we know you're trying to get at, which is not to have your builders have this expense of people trying to discover who they are and just let them know who they are and what that was. And now we're kind of going through the minefield. It's a good idea, but how do we make this work? So what I would ask to do, and I'll give you a 10-day deal if that we can do that, using the great expertise of Mr. Chisholm, Mr. Miles, and others, we've identified where the concern is, to see if we can collectively use our brain power to see how we might accomplish the goal in a way that's also workable in a cost-effective manner. And if you would report back to Ms. Van Winkle, if we have something that, we figure out how we can do this, then we will bring the bill back with those suggestions and see if we could proceed. Is that fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 574. And we're going to go open a little bit out of order, open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 212. Let's see. Looks like Cheryl Pellegrini is the defer. Okay. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice. I serve as an Assistant Attorney General in the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. And first off, thank you very much for allowing us to present this bill at this time. We have some public members here to testify as well. I'll be brief and outlining the basis for this bill. Senate Bill 212 addresses what we have observed as being a gap in Oregon law. Currently, there's no government agency in Oregon that has the authority to address business practices that violate Oregon's Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. This act is what's known as a self-enforcing act, much like Oregon's Lemon Law. That means that the only way it can be enforced is by a private lawsuit brought by a person who is injured by the unlawful practices of a debt collector, as defined. The Oregon Department of Justice, as I said, lacks jurisdiction in this area to take action against debt collectors that violate these state laws. As a result, we're not able to provide assistance to individual debtors who file complaints with us that a collector has violated a provision or to halt ongoing practices that violate state law. Now, consumers may file a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission for violations of the Federal Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act. However, the Federal Trade Commission does not provide individual consumer assistance. We contacted them this afternoon to find out what their practice is. They are not permitted to act as counsel in or for a private action brought by one or more individuals. While in theory, the Federal Trade Commission could bring an action based on a single consumer complaint, in practice, the Federal Trade Commission brings actions where there appears to be a significant and multiple or multi-state problem, where numerous consumers are affected, and where it is difficult or impossible for a single state to effectively curtail an illegal activity. What this means, for all practical purposes, is that the Federal Trade Commission is not in a position, it has not been their policy, and it has never been their practice to take action against a debt collector who is operating solely in Oregon or whose unlawful practices affect Oregonians only. The Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services is a regulator in this area. However, their regulation is limited. They require third-party collectors and also first-party collectors that have a separate collection arm to register as a collection agency and to obtain either a surety bond in the amount of $10,000 or an irrevocable letter of credit. Although the Department of Consumer and Business Services has the authority to revoke a collection agency's registration, in the past 4 years they have not done so based on violations of the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. In fact, the department sees its role here as regulating the business practices of the collection agency with regard to the creditor that will hire a collection agency to collect its debt, as opposed to advocating or performing a consumer protection function. The Department of Consumer and Business Services does not have the authority to assist individual consumers in resolving complaints, nor does it have the authority to seek restitution for law violations. The Department of Consumer and Business Services refers all consumer complaints to us, the Department of Justice, or to the Federal Trade Commission. Now, since 2001, and I would note that in talking with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, I looked at their website. As of December 31st, 2003, there were 552 collection agencies registered with the department. And an
what was that number again, please?
I'm sorry, it was 552.
Okay.
And I spoke with an official from the department this morning, Mr. Charles Donald, and he advised that what they're seeing there are a large number of unregistered collectors operating in Oregon. Now, and as you know, unregistered collectors fall beyond the reach of the department's regulatory authority. Since 2001, the volume of complaints about debt collection practices has been substantial enough to put this industry on the Department of Justice's top 10 consumer complaint list for the first time. Since that time, they've gone from number 10 in 2001 to 2003, where they were, I believe, number 6, and in 2004, last year, they ranked number 5.
It's like they're going for number 1, huh?
It appears so. In 2003, the Department of Justice received 431 written complaints about debt collection agencies and 1,388 written complaints about what we call first-party debt collectors. Those are creditors who collect their own debts. In 2004, we received 410 written complaints about third-party debt collectors and 1,128 written complaints about first-party debt collectors. Both of these types of collectors are covered under Oregon State Debt Collection Practices Act provisions. Now, as I said, this law is self-enforcing. However, it's been our experience, and what you'll hear, I think, as well, is that individuals who are subjected to unlawful debt collection practices often, by virtue of their circumstances, are either not able to retain private counsel or not able to file a lawsuit. In addition, there have been some individuals who have taken advantage of the private right of action, and it has proved ineffective in curbing unlawful practices.
And why is that?
Because I think, as you'll hear, the collector persisted after the individual obtained a judgment. department and Attorney General Myers believes that additional authority is needed in this area. Contrary to what you may hear from the industry, it is not an over-regulated industry. In fact, there's a marked lack of government ability to intervene on behalf of consumers. Private remedies are not regulation, nor are they a substitute for regulation. The Federal Trade Commission does not regulate this industry. Currently, no state consumer protection agency has authority to handle individual consumer complaints. Senate Bill 212, it's crafted carefully. It would make a violation of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act an unconscionable practice under Oregon Revised Statute 646607. Now, that's within the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, but it is a part of the Act that is enforceable only by the Attorney General. It is not enforceable through private action, so we are not creating a redundant private cause of action here. What this does is two things. One, it gives our staff the ability to handle and resolve individual consumer complaints short of a lawsuit. And two, it gives the Attorney General's office the ability to step in where individuals cannot to halt an unlawful pattern of practice. There are three individual citizens here that would like to address the committee. In addition, there was a fourth citizen, Mr. James Bennett, who could not be here today, but who provided a letter which I think was included with my written testimony. I'd be happy to take any questions. Otherwise, I would get out of the way and let these people come up and talk to you.
Well, I would have a couple of questions, first of all, just so I'm clear about this, Ms. Pellegrini. So what this would do is we're not making any new laws. What we're saying, we're giving the consumer the opportunity to empower the Attorney General's office to act on their behalf to enforce the laws that we already have.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Well, it's interesting. I was unaware of the growth of complaints. And generally, as we have found, whether it's payday lending or telephone solicitation, when you start getting complaints that increase, that generally that's a sign that we have an issue here. So I appreciate bringing that forward. Questions for Ms. Pellegrini before we bring the testimony up from the
one,
Senator Moss Anderson?
Small question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about your workload then? Will you need more staff to be able to carry this out if this bill passes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz-Anderson, no, this bill has no fiscal impact. What we would do, and what we do is we arrange our enforcement priorities partly based on consumer trends that we're seeing like this and partly based on the Attorney General's enforcement agenda. So what we would do is that we would shift existing resources to address what we saw as a growing problem.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what form would the action take? So the Attorney General gets involved. I just read Mr. Bennett's letter, and then I guess in that circumstance, if you're familiar with the letter, would you just send a letter from the Attorney General to the, in this case, Allied Interstate, instructing them to stop contacting this individual?
Yes, what we would do, what our process is, is if an individual files a consumer complaint with our office, it would go to one of three enforcement officers. The first course of action that we take is that we notify the business that we've received the complaint, and we ask the business to provide us with its side of the story. If there's an easy way to resolve it, if it's a lack of communication, or if the consumer hadn't received prior notices, we would act as a liaison between the consumer and the business and try to informally resolve the complaint. We can't do that now. That's what we would do. If those attempts failed, or in the event that we received a number of complaints about the same company engaged in the same sort of practice that clearly violated the law, that might inform us that that is a company that needs more formal action. Although we would always notify the company first that we had received complaints and ask it to provide its side of the story in terms of, you know, why, what practices it had engaged in.
Mm-hmm. Senator Starr.
Thank you. You just said that the Department of Justice cannot play that liaison role, that informal role, and yet in this testimony or letter from Mr. Bennett, it seems that the the Department of Justice did exactly that. Can you unravel that for me?
Yes. When we get complaints, often if the enforcement officers have the ability, they'll make a call. We have no enforcement authority in this area. While an enforcement officer could make a call and did in this particular instance, if the company refused to comply, we can't do anything.
Other questions?
So there's really no impetus.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's bring Charles Dickinson, Amanda Grayson, Barbara Rodriguez forward. And I will point out those are the only other people who have to testify to give us our direction on this bill.
Make Kevin Neely come up and testify.
Yes, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Barbara Rodriguez, and the reason I'm here doesn't really have anything to do with me. I don't owe financial network company any money. I've never had a credit card with them. My son serves with the Oregon National Guard, 2 to 162nd out of Corvallis, and his wife owns a credit card from Victoria's Secrets, and there was a missed payment. This company has called and harassed me every week in the month of February. I told them my son will be home by Easter, God willing, and he will pay his debts. He will communicate with them. He's been in Baghdad, north of Baghdad, 20 miles. Since he's been in Iraq, he's been blown up in his Humvee. He has been shot at. He's picked up his fellow soldiers' body parts. And I am not going to tell him he has a credit card company wanting a payment while he is over there. And the young man that called and insists that I give him my son's cell number in Baghdad, I asked him, so you'd call my son if you could in Baghdad. And he said, certainly, your son is doing me no favors fighting this war. And I said, well, quite frankly, I don't see it that way. And he said, I asked if I could talk to his supervisor. And he told me his supervisor's name was Maria Gray. And I could not talk to her. And he would continue to call my house until my son comes home. And there was nothing I could do about it. All three of my kids are in the military, all active duty, and I'm not changing my phone number. I have a few options here. I can pay the bill to shut these people up. I can wait and let my son deal with it when he comes home, which is the option I'm going to take. He's a grown-up adult. He created the debt. He owes the money. He will pay the money. But I'm not going to give in and give these people the money per their harassment. And I think it's wrong for them to keep pushing the issue with me. I don't owe them any money. I don't have an account with them. And I just really feel like they're wrong. I don't represent the military, but I brought my little picture because this is Bulldog, Team Bulldog. They're due to come home. They've been through a lot. I'm not looking for sympathy. I'm looking for your help. The only avenue we have to protect them and these guys sitting next to me who don't have anything to do with the military either, is through your help with giving the ability to help people who want to pay the bill or who will pay the bill without this form of harassment. I'm lucky enough to, I don't have to deal with this. Our bills are paid at home and I don't have to deal with collectors on a personal basis. But pretty much all I have to say.
Thank you.
And being a small world, this man knows the wife of someone in my picture, and this young lady knows another man. I mean, obviously, the practices of these collection agencies is out there more than I realize.
Why don't you go ahead?
My name is Amanda Grayson, and I want to state right off that I work for an attorney's office up in Portland. I have resources available to me that aren't necessarily available to the other two people sitting at this desk. You know, when you work in an office for with five attorneys, I can find out the answers very quickly. I've also been a legal secretary assistant for about 8 years. How this all happened, this is over an $8.95 check. I had stopped payment on a bunch of checks because I lost them. And I didn't want somebody writing a bunch of checks. I didn't realize that all my checks in my checkbooks had been stopped. So when I was writing checks, it was too late. And lo and behold, I missed a check. It was for $8.95. I got a phone call. I returned the phone call. The guy only told me his name was Craig. He said, call me back. I called him back. Said, I'm a collection agency. I said, well, that's great. He goes, you owe $50. And I said, for what? For an $8.95 check. He said, yes. Are you prepared to give me a credit or debit card number over the phone? When I indicated that I wasn't going to, he started getting a little bit irate with me about the fact, and I said I told him I didn't have any documentation from him in regards to the fact that I owed this debt. He harassed me a bit more on the phone, told me that if I didn't pay, it would go up to $60. He said it would go up to $60. In 8 days, it would go up to $60. I said that was ridiculous, considering I hadn't been put on notice and the fact that I owed this debt. I do take the responsibility that it was my fault. I missed the check. I was totally prepared to pay the $8.95 plus the $25 stop payment fee that my bank would have charged them, or they would have charged me. I was very frustrated at that point. I hung up on him. I did call the attorney that I worked for at home, and her and I talked about some stuff that I could do. The next day, I called back asking to talk to a supervisor. The person I was on the phone with refused to talk to me about my debt. I tried to get to the supervisor. When I finally did get to the supervisor, I realized after I left the voicemail that I had just left the voicemail for the same guy that I had talked to the night before. Realizing that I needed to find out more information about this debt that I owed, I had to call this guy back. I called him back, and he started in on me about how are we going to get past this, Amanda? We need to get past this. You need to just pay this debt and just let it go. You told me all this. And I was talking to him in a nice, even tone while he was screaming at me on the other end. I decided that I told him that I felt that he was violating the act. He was violating the act by harassing me, the fact, and intimidating me on the phone. I work for attorneys. I don't get intimidated very easily. I did get off the phone with him after a long conversation. He actually physically made me upset. I even told one of the attorneys I worked for, and he asked if he could call. I did manage to get the debt taken care of with the person that I made the debt with directly, and they indicated to me that it should have never been sent to collections. By Friday after this happened, I indicated I was actually extremely upset that I filed a complaint with the AG of Oregon, the AG of Washington, the FTC, Better Business Bureau, and another association that this credit company was associated with. I also finally received the letter that he had told me that he had sent out to me on the 16th. It's dated for the 18th of February, and I have a postmark for the 22nd of February. In the letter, it's indicated that I have 15 days to pay this or it will go up to X amount. On the phone, he told me it was 8 days. This notice was not given to me in a timely manner to begin with, and right there I have basis to file a complaint against him. I have heard back from the AG of Oregon. They indicated they couldn't do anything about it. I heard back from the AG of Washington. They're asking for more information. The company is based in Washington. The debt was based in Oregon. I heard back from the Better Business Bureau. I have taken care of this debt. But I also have resources available to me that other people don't. And, you know, if this happened to one of my friends, they'd end up coming for me. These guys don't have any, they don't have anywhere to go. And so if you add to this, if you let somebody else help with the fact that we need to get this, we need to get these things taken care of, these guys will have someplace to go. Not everybody knows.
Let's go to Mr. Dickerson here.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Charlie Dickerson. My wife is a breast cancer survivor that developed a lump, and we accrued several medical bills surrounding this surgery. And my wife set up a budget and laid them all out, because you don't just get one bill anymore. Well, the surgeon wouldn't accept the terms of our what we could afford to pay, and immediately just sent the bill off to a collection agency. And at that time, we moved from our residence, and we never received anything in the mail from the collection agency. We thought we had things forwarded, but we didn't receive anything. And then in April of last year, we began to get phone calls. The guy identified himself as Robert, left a return phone number and a reference number, and our greeting specifically asked for details. We want to know who's calling and why. So we ignored those phone calls. And on the 27th of that month, this Robert called my wife at work, and her boss informed him that she's not allowed personal phone calls. A half hour later, he called again there, asked for her title at where she works, so she ended up talking to him on the phone. He was very rude. He did offer, he said, "We'll send you a bill if you think you want to pay it," was his tone of voice, very rude, condescending. Later that night, he called and he left a message that was, again, rude. It's, "Stop playing games," and my wife immediately returned the phone call. He threatened to call me at work until she put him on the phone with me. I told him not to call me at work, but told him send us a bill so we could pay it. And I said that in that conversation several times. And during that conversation, he called me a deadbeat. So we waited for a bill and began to do some internet research on what can we do about this. Well, days went by, no bill. We did contact somebody in the Department of Consumer and Business Services named Charles Donald, who talked to the manager. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. We waited for the bill, and 3 weeks later, somebody shows up in the driveway with the writ of garnishment. That's what we got. We didn't get a bill, no chance to pay. We didn't even know who was after us as far as the money goes. A week later, we received another writ of garnishment. Mr. Donald talked to the manager of this collection agency, who did say in his return email, which I have a copy, that yeah, they did have 5 days to send us a bill, which we didn't get. And and said that no action would be taken if we made payments. We began to make payments. My wife sent them three $50 checks, so of course the third one. And when she made the third one, that was the day before payday, the collection agency went in and totally wiped out her bank account, took everything out of it. So it paid to date at that point $100 in payments, and then they took $951.30 out of an $874 debt. Her bank account was closed. There were 8 overdraft charges to $80. There was NSF fees to $119 and a $40 garnishment fee, and the account was closed. We filed a claim of exemption with Benton County Court, and we had a hearing on 8/27/04. And the same day, they refiled another writ that added more fees, such as interest, and they even handwrote in an NSF charge for a check that bounced because they had totally taken her bank account away from her.
Mr. Dickinson, I'm not. I think we're getting the drift here. What I'd like to do is, if we could, if three of you would just stand down now, and I'm going to ask Ms. Pellegrini, who got your stories. I want to get something from her, and Mr. Marquis would like to testify from represents those folks. So, but I have a couple questions here. So, Cheryl, if you could come back up, I want to get a clarity here first of all. Okay. you've heard these stories, and I assume you knew about those stories. What I want to get a handle on, first of all, we're talking about the practices. What we're dealing with this bill is what is illegal. Are all the stories that we heard, first of all, currently illegal? And that's the first question. I mean, because we're talking about giving you enforcement power to intercede on their behalf. And that's the first thing I want to say is if any of those, they might be annoying, but were legal or not, or whether those are all acts that would be considered illegal.
Mr. Chair, let me get the act out for you so I can cite you to the particular provisions.
Are we at 646-607?
We are at 646-639,
okay.
Which is the
yes.
Unlawful debt collection practices provision. Section 2D, it is shall be an unlawful practice to use abusive language in communicating with a debtor or the family. To communicate with a debtor or any member of the debtor's family repeatedly or continuously, or at times known to be inconvenient to that person with intent to harass or annoy the debtor or any member of the debtor's family. To communicate or threaten to communicate with a debtor's employer concerning the nature or existence of the debt. To telephone a debtor's place of employment. I'm at 2... 2GB. There's certain prohibitions mm-hmm. about contacting people at the place of employment.
Okay.
To communicate with a debtor orally without disclosing to the debtor within 30 seconds the name of the individual making the contact and the true purpose thereof. So I think, in a word, yes. I mean, there are several of these practices that members of the public have just told the committee about that would constitute violations of Oregon law.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Markey, as we wind down here, whichever one of you, Matt signed up, but whatever one of you wants to come up. Cheryl, why don't you stay here, please? Let's go.
Stay?
Come on.
Stay?
Please stay.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence. I was in another meeting, and I apologize. Jim Markey, for the record, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. We have about 100 collection agencies in the state of Oregon that are members of our association. We oppose this bill, and I really know nothing about the fact situation in this case, so I'm not going to really comment on that. I was instrumental in writing this piece of this statute that exists relative to debt collection practices in Oregon. Our that the bill that created that statute was introduced at the request of our association many years ago, and I believe that collection agencies should be regulated, and I believe that they should act in a professional manner when collecting debts, and I believe that most of our members believe that. The collection agencies are known as third-party debt collectors. That is, they are not collecting their own debts, but collecting debts for another party under contract. Third-party debt collectors are regulated by the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. First-party collectors are not. And that law is administered by the Federal Trade Commission. Under that law, there is a right of private action by an aggrieved party for $1,000 or actual damages together with whichever is greater, together with attorney fees, punitive damages, and costs. The Federal Trade Commission also has the ability to levy civil penalties. And I wasn't here, but someone said it was said that they don't do that. Well, talk to PAYCO, who paid a $3.1 million civil penalty, and they'll tell you they do. We created this Oregon law, and it applies to all debt collectors. And we believe that's something that ought to be in the law. And it follows very closely the federal law, although there are some differences. And under the Debt Collection Practices Act of Oregon, a debtor has a right of private action for $200 or actual damages, together with attorney fees, punitive damages, and costs. And believe me, there are lots of attorneys out there more than willing to sue collection agencies. I could show you many examples where somebody has made a simple mistake and been sued. This adds a third layer of regulation for these types of practices, whereby the Attorney General would now enter the fray and have civil penalty enforcement and a right of action against the collection agency, with, I believe, their position is that on those types of actions, there's no statute of limitations. We believe this is a bit of an overreach for third-party debt collectors, because they're already regulated by the federal government, and there's already the right of private action under the Debt Collection Practices Act. Beyond this regulation, collection agencies are also regulated by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. However, the Department of Business and of Consumer and Business Services does not regulate this kind of activity, but rather they register collection agencies, basically a licensing act, although it's called registration, not licensing. And they make and their job is to make sure that nobody absconds with any money, either once a debtor's paid, that somebody doesn't run off with the money. They have to be bonded and all of those kinds of things. So both, I believe that under the current law, both customers of collection agencies, those businesses that contract with collection agencies, are protected. And I believe that consumers do have adequate recourse now for violations of these acts. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Burkett, here's the problem I have with this, is that you talked about how your organization helped write the law.
Yes.
So obviously they believe in following those practices.
Yes.
Well, we've heard about people who aren't following those practices or allegedly have not followed those practices. And I would think that your association, like in other organizations that we hear, whether it's construction or payday lending or others, would say, you know, we're following the law. We want to take aggressive action against those who are ruining our reputation, ruining the kind of work that we do. And we heard from the testimony of these folks, maybe they technically have access, but most of them aren't going to go employ an attorney and a lot of attorneys if they don't think there's a lot there. That may happen in some cases, but in the real world, we know the general citizen isn't going to be doing this. So I help me understand why, since you were so active in writing this law, that you wouldn't want to make sure that people had, number one, the ability to get at these people who are hurting your industry members' name, number one, and number two, perhaps to solve some of these problems when they get on, so that the Attorney General, if they get a letter from the Attorney General, hey, maybe we stop that practice and we don't have to get into a litigious situation. And help me understand that a little bit.
Mr. Chair, it's a question of how many agencies do you want to give civil penalty authority to? The Federal Trade Commission could levy a civil penalty, and the AG could come in and levy a civil penalty right on top of them. I mean, is that fair? It's a little, I sort of laugh about this. Driving through Clackamas County, I get a ticket from a city policeman in Milwaukee. And the sheriff of the county says, I'm going to give you a ticket, too, for the same deal. And the state cop says, I'm going to give you a third ticket. I mean, how many tickets do you think you ought to get for speeding? I mean, that's the issue to me.
How do you answer this question? Ms. Pellegrini has pointed out that in the year 2001, some collection agencies, I don't want to say members of your association, but this issue, consumer complaints and this practice, you know, hit their top 10 list of complaints, you know, and has been moving up ever since. Now, that would just tell me anecdotally, we've got a problem, because if this is growing in number, then there's something in the system that isn't working. So maybe you can identify for me what in that system isn't working. If it's not this as a solution, then what is it that makes this continue to grow?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would note that in her testimony, she says that they're actually down in 2004 from 2003. Not much, but they're down. So the trend is, according to her testimony, downward, not upward. And secondly, I've not been privy to see any of those complaints, so I have no idea what the nature of the complaints are, nor do I know what the disposition of them are.
Questions for either Ms. Pellegrini or Mr. Markey?
Well,
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Jim, I missed a part of your testimony, so this is some way unfair for me. But I guess I would just, because I'd benefit from it, in listening to the panel, and I'm not sure if you had the benefit of hearing from the panel that preceded yourself, but in listening to them, it seemed to make common sense that we would allow at least the AG to send that letter off and say to the woman, my son's in Baghdad, or he's in Baghdad, please stop contacting the mother while the son's in Baghdad. That just seemed to kind of pass the nod test, but I should definitely hear the rationale against that.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I didn't hear all of what was said, and I'm not privy to the fact situation here. I would say that what I did hear was that a writ of garnishment was issued. If a writ of garnishment was issued, there was a lawsuit. If there was a lawsuit, and there was a judgment rendered by a court of law, and if there was a judgment rendered by a court of law and there was a lawsuit, papers were served. People knew what was going on, and I would just, so I mean, I don't know what this fact situation is, but when you've got a judgment entered against you, there has been a lawsuit filed and papers served to you, and you've had a chance to respond to that or have your day in court. So I mean, I don't know, again, because I wasn't there. My point is dual regulation. How many agencies do you want to give jurisdiction? That's the real question.
Anything else, Senator Decker?
No, thank you very much. Thank you.
Anybody else? Ms. Pellegrini, would you mind just responding to Mr. Markey's response to your comments?
Yes. Real quickly, two things. With regard to civil penalty authority, that's something that I think what Mr. Markey is referring to is if the Department of Justice were to file a lawsuit and if it were to prevail in court, it could seek civil penalties under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act for up to $25,000 per violation. Unlike a regulatory agency like the Department of Consumer and Business Services, we don't just issue civil penalties. I mean, that's at the end of a lawsuit. And as I previously testified, what I would tell you that I would say about 99% of the enforcement actions that we take settle short of a civil lawsuit. They settle with the entry of a business into an assurance of voluntary compliance, pay restitution, shift costs, and change the business practices. So usually civil penalties aren't a part of what we do, although there is sometimes a deterrent payment. So to say that we would impose a civil penalty where the FTC had already acted, I don't think that has happened. Well, it hasn't happened because we don't have authority. And the other thing is that if the Federal Trade Commission acts and addresses conduct, then the states don't step in. I mean, the Federal Trade Commission and the states work to fill gaps in one another's resources and enforcement authority. And you'll see that over and over again. If the Federal Trade Commission takes an action against a company that's operating multi-state, often states will defer and not file an action, or will only file an action to address a group of citizens not addressed by the Federal Trade Commission's action. So that's number one. Number two, as to the consumer complaints going down, all of the consumer complaints, the total number of consumer complaints in 2004 went down. In 2003, there were 14,000 and something. In 2004, there were just over 10,000 overall. Of those 10,000, debt collectors still went up on the list. The reason that the overall number of complaints went down is because the Department of Justice lost staff as a result of decisions in the 2003 Assembly when we lost all public funding. We've not been doing outreach and education, and as a result, one casualty that we've noticed is that consumers as a whole are sending less complaints to us. So the fact that there are fewer complaints filed, I don't think there are fewer complaints filed overall, but of the ones that were filed proportionally, debt collectors went up on the list, and that is significant.
We're at our time of our meeting. We're going to continue to discuss this issue, but for this moment, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 212. Senate Bill 211, obviously, we're not going to be able to get to today. Under the rules of the Senate, that could be considered as due notice for next Tuesday, but we have that time anyway, and we may post that at that time. We'll have to look at the schedule and see whether that fits in. This has been a very interesting discussion.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and the committee is adjourned.